Our speaker is Brother Colin Badger. His subject is David, the Stranger and Sojourner. Today's title, We Must Through Much Tribulation Enter the Kingdom.
Good morning, brothers and sisters. Our topic for this series of classes, brothers and sisters, is intended to be a thematic study of David from a particular perspective, that being David viewed as a stranger and a sojourner. And that really defines fairly narrowly only several phases, really, of David's life. We intend to look in particular and give most of our emphasis to what we would call two main phases in David's life: when he was a fugitive from home, when he was a fugitive from his own native home. The first phase that we're speaking of, really, would be that time in David's life when he was a fugitive fleeing from Saul. And then, towards the end of his life, that second phase relating to the latter period when David fled at the time of Absalom's rebellion. Now, there are other very significant periods, or stages, we could say, in David's life, no doubt. The period of David's youth, the time in which he was preparing the ark, the time of David's great battles, which went through several phases, but as important and as thrilling as those episodes were in David's life, we are not going to be considering those as part of our consideration. Therefore, it's not a complete study of the life of David. The handout which you have been given, brothers and sisters, perhaps we could just look at that. What we have done is taken from David's life some of the key highlights in the various phases of his life. We see how it starts off, for example, when David was a shepherd. And the diagram works on a kind of ascending scale and then a descending scale deliberately in order to convey a certain concept, which is very much part of our approach to our studies on David this week. We're looking at two periods in David's life, and the two that I've just defined for you are those periods on the chart which are marked by a thin black line and a heavier line. And you can see that the first one falls after the time of David being in the court of Saul. And the second period that we're going to be looking at is the period over to the right of your chart following his sin with Bathsheba. So we've deliberately used a different kind of line marker to designate the two periods we're going to be looking at. And as we've said, the chart really is intended to convey a kind of concept. That David went through, we could say, peaks and valleys in his life. There were periods where he ascended to great heights of power, not only in the eyes of man, but also from a spiritual point of view. And there were times which he went through that were depressing. Times of trial and tribulation when David's patience and where his own spirituality was taxed and wore very, very thin. And thus, the idea of rises and falls on the chart are simply meant in a very general sweep to convey where David is at, spiritually speaking, at certain stages in his life. You'll also notice we've provided some passages in Samuel, 1 and 2, in order to help you locate roughly where some of those events are. And we've also provided you with some psalms, which we are fairly sure relate to some of those respective periods in David's life. Many psalms can't be identified for sure as to what phase they relate to in David's life, and perhaps some of them deliberately could apply to both. But the psalms we have provided for you on that chart are psalms that we can be relatively sure relate to that specific period in David's life. And at the bottom of the chart, you'll notice we have put in a number of psalms which really have as their theme David in trouble. And they could relate, we would say, to probably both periods in David's life. A little less possible with some of those psalms to be dogmatic. We believe, brothers and sisters, that there is good reason to give careful consideration to these two phases that we're speaking about in David's life when he lived the life of a fugitive. For it was during those periods in David's life, when David, living the life of a fugitive, made really some of his most significant spiritual gains. It's also during those two periods that David's discipleship was tested in ways with which we can most clearly identify. When considering the period during which David was a fugitive from Saul, for example, and then the period when David was a fugitive from Absalom during the rebellion period, we should be alert to exhortational lessons which both of those phases have in common, but will also benefit a great deal if we were alert to the differences. Both periods in David's life had therefore many similarities in terms of the exhortational value to ourselves and, of course, to David. But there were some unique differences in those two phases because of the circumstances which placed David in those events. And we'll note, therefore, both the differences and the similarities, and note how each has a certain kind of exhortational value. By way of perspective, first of all, through introduction, I'd like to look at a number of statements in the New Testament which should set for us, I believe, a perspective that we need to bring to bear when we take a look at David the fugitive. Would you turn with me to, first of all, this statement in Acts, chapter 14. Acts chapter 14. There is a scriptural perspective here which has a relevance to David's life as a fugitive. The Apostle Paul is speaking here in Acts 14, and the place, of course, is the area of Ephesus where he's talking to the elders. And according to Paul's understanding at the time, it would be the last time he would be able to admonish the elders of Ephesus. We notice the perspective, the spiritual perspective, which Paul shares with them here in Acts 14. Verse 22. Confirming the souls of the disciples and exhorting them to continue in the faith, and that we must through much tribulation enter into the kingdom of God. It's a very basic perspective, but you know it's one that we can very easily lose sight of. It's all right to give mental cognizance, mental agreement to the fact that Paul said to the elders of Ephesus that we must through much tribulation enter the kingdom of God. But in practical terms, what does that mean to us, and what did it mean to them? Obviously, it's expressing the divine perspective that not only for brothers and sisters in the first century, but for brothers and sisters down through the years until the kingdom comes, they must expect, they must conform to, they must get along with the reality that disciples will face tribulation. But it says more than that. It doesn't just say we must through tribulation enter the kingdom of God. It says we must through much tribulation enter the kingdom of God. A divine perspective, one that David himself no doubt did not totally understand, nor did it run natural to David's own inclination spiritually. He was to learn that through experience. And the man who's speaking here, the Apostle Paul, himself learned through practical experience that it was through much tribulation that the Apostle Paul was going to be prepared for the future kingdom. We keep that in mind as we view David's many, many difficulties and these two phases when he is a fugitive. Let's look at 1 Peter. The context for this passage is appropriate. Both 1 and 2 Peter were penned at a time that were at the very advent, practically, of AD 70. The brothers and sisters to whom Peter writes were brothers and sisters under trial and tribulation. Roman authorities were putting their pressure on their own daily circumstances. By the second epistle, there were problems both within and without the ecclesia that were assailing them. These were brothers and sisters who knew what it was to taste tribulation. Now, in 1 Peter chapter 2, there is a perspective given, which is very much in harmony with Paul's warning to the elders of Ephesus. 1 Peter chapter 2, Verse 9. But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Now, before we go any further in the next few verses, let's adjust our minds to the spiritual perspective. That language is drawing upon the Old Testament. It is being written to brothers and sisters in the New Testament in Asia Minor who are in the crucible of tribulation and difficulty. They are brothers and sisters who need encouragement to face their trials. And he extracts, Peter does, by the Spirit's guidance, a reminder from Old Testament language in both Exodus and Leviticus that they are a royal priesthood. They are a holy nation. They are a peculiar people. Terms of reference from Exodus and Leviticus as they were applied to the nation of Israel. And then in verse 9, towards the second half, that ye should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. What does that remind you of? That's the language of Exodus. That's an innuendo, we could say, or an echo back into the Exodus period, where the people of Israel were brought out of Egypt, out of darkness, and both spiritually and literally brought by that pillar of fire and by that cloud into a marvelous light, which accompanied them and ushered them across the Red Sea and during the period of 40 years wandering. Now, this is not a digression from what we first began with. How do you encourage brothers and sisters like those in Asia Minor who are going through severe trials? How do you encourage them? From the Spirit's perspective, you tell them about the Exodus. You remind them that the people of Israel came out of Egypt under great stress and trial. You remind them of their high calling. You encourage them that they are a peculiar people and a holy nation. In the spirit psychology, if we could use that terminology, it is useful. It is important to people under trial and difficulty to remind them about those kind of spiritual perspectives. Now, furthermore, verse 10, he tells these brothers and sisters in stress and difficulty that in time past, speaking again of Israel, were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. He's drawing from various parts of the Old Testament, partly here from Hosea. Verse 11, dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul. Keep in mind to whom he is speaking. How do you encourage brothers and sisters that are in trial and difficulty? When the Roman authorities were putting them in jail, very close to the time of Nero's persecution, very close to the time when apostasy was beginning to have its encroachments within the ecclesia. How do you encourage brothers and sisters in those kinds of periods of time? Well, apart from what we've seen in verse 9 and 10, verse 9 in part, one thing you remind them of in verse 11, according to Peter, you remind them that they are strangers and pilgrims on the earth. A divine perspective. To encourage brothers and sisters in that kind of environment, with those kind of tests and trials, you remind them of their lifestyle. You remind them that they are anyways on the earth to live as pilgrims and sojourners. What's the practical import of that? For people who are being harassed by government authorities, and for people who are facing difficulties both from within and without the ecclesia, you help brothers and sisters and you remind them that they are pilgrims on the earth, that they are sojourners on the earth. And that divine perspective is intended to help brothers and sisters cope, to help them deal with the pressures from within and from without the ecclesia. Now, we're going to keep David in mind here. David was to learn that through much tribulation, he, David, was to enter the kingdom. But David was also to learn that he had to go through a period in his life that showed him the value of living as a sojourner and a stranger on the earth. And when David was placed in the crucible of trial, and when David's faith was to be tested, when loyalty to the ecclesia was at stake and loyalty to his God, David was to learn through that practical experience, just as the brothers and sisters in Asia Minor, that by seeing life as being a temporary passage, by David viewing himself as a stranger and sojourner, he would find the divine perspective necessary to bring him through successfully. It would teach David, as it must teach us, and it was to teach the brothers and sisters in Asia Minor, that this life is passing. And if you lose home in those situations of duress, if you are thrown in prison, if you do face that kind of loss, you remind yourself that you are a stranger and a pilgrim anyways on the earth, and these things aren't permanent. Now, our third passage, by way of perspective, is in Hebrews. It simply reinforces the two we've just looked at. And we're going to refer to these three passages, remind you of them, periodically as we get into the details of David the fugitive. Hebrews chapter 11. I know you're familiar with this chapter and with the many mighty men and women of faith which are cataloged. But there is a perspective here that relates very much to the life of David when he was a fugitive and a sojourner. Hebrews chapter 11, drawing from the experience of Abraham, verse 9. By faith he sojourned in the land of promise, as in a strange country, dwelling in tabernacles with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. A divine perspective. It is, in fact, the divine lifestyle. Whether in city or town, whether on the hills of Judea, or whether in the city of Jerusalem, wherever they were to find themselves, they were to look at themselves and to look at their environment by that kind of divine interpretation that Abraham had. To see themselves living lives of faith, sojourning. And in the case of Abraham, he was right within the promised land, treading on the very soil that was promised. But even though he was within the promised land, he still was to live the life of a sojourner and a pilgrim. We continue just a little further. Verse 13. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. Do you know, there's a point in David's life where somebody besides David confesses to David that he, David, is a stranger and a sojourner. That is said to David. And at the very end of David's life, David himself makes the confession of Hebrews 11, as we'll see. David himself used this very language to describe his relationship to his place on earth and his relationship to his father in his present condition. It is a perspective, brothers and sisters, which David was to learn by experience. And thus, with those three passages in mind and those basic principles, we remind ourselves of how to view the life of David. The three of them, indeed, are all from the New Testament. But that's not a perspective, obviously, riveted just to the Old Testament. Let's just remind ourselves, in the passage in Deuteronomy, the people of Israel were given this divine perspective very early on in their national existence. Deuteronomy chapter 8. One of the most succinct statements in all the Bible about how to view trial and tribulation, and how the Father views trial and tribulation, and what his intention is behind that trial and tribulation. Deuteronomy chapter 8. Verse 2. Speaking to this new generation to come up and enter into the land. Verse 2. Thou shalt remember all the way which the Lord thy God led thee these 40 years in the wilderness, to humble thee and to prove thee, to know what was in thine heart, whether thou wouldst keep his commandments or no. Let's just stop there and digest carefully the divine perspective that's spelled out there. Looking back over the past 40 years and speaking now to the new generation that is about to enter the land under Joshua's leadership, there's a divine perspective now given, and it has a very practical bearing, not only for that generation, but for ourselves and for the way we're going to view David as a fugitive. It's this in verse 2. The purpose of the wilderness. That's where David spent a great deal of his early life. It's where he still had to resort to after the rebellion under Absalom. David spent many, many days in the wilderness himself. And in doing so, in a very real contact with the wilderness, David's personal experiences ran parallel with the experience spelled out here in verse 2. What was the purpose of a wilderness existence? Number one, to humble thee. And so it did David. Secondly, to prove or to test thee. Thirdly, to know what was in thine heart. You see the point. From a practical point of view, when you and I go through the life's difficulties that we all have faced and will face, or perhaps are now facing, we may struggle with those difficulties. We may resist those trials. We may ask ourselves, why is it that I am going through this trial now? We may ask, why me? Why? There's the answer. That was the answer for David, and that's the answer for you and I. Why? Why do we go through the wilderness experience, figuratively speaking? To humble us, to test us, and to know what is in our hearts. Verse 3. And it worked. And he humbled thee, and suffered thee to hunger, and fed thee with manna, which thou knewest not, neither did thy fathers know, that he might make thee know that man doth not live by bread only. You see, God is telling Israel, in case they didn't get the point in the middle of the circumstance, that now they could look back in retrospect at that past generation of 40 years. And they could interpret their experiences and the experiences of the lost generation from this divine perspective. Now, brothers and sisters, David, as we said, is about to go into the wilderness as we look at the first phase of his life. Why did David have to go into the wilderness? Why did he have to live the life of a fugitive for so long before he became king? There are the reasons, right there. To prove David, to humble David, and to see what was in David's heart. And you know, if there's one phrase that relates as a description to David, it has to do with David's heart. Time and time again, the scriptural description of David was that he was a man after God's own heart. The heart of David is one of the key focuses of Scripture. And there's the point, that in going through those tribulations, in facing those tests, David's heart was revealed. And it was pleasing to God as it finally came through the test. And when we go through trials and difficulties, ecclesial tensions, problems in our own lives, lack of health, difficulties that tax our faith and our faithfulness to God and to the ecclesia, if we ask ourselves why, as we always do, there are the reasons. Three of them, given very simply. One other passage before we get into Samuel. It's in Leviticus, still in the Old Testament, and given to Israel very early on. Leviticus chapter 25. This does provide a slightly different slant to some of the things we've just been discussing. Leviticus chapter 25 is dealing, if you'll look at the beginning of the chapter, with the years of Jubilee. And it's dealing, first of all, with the Sabbath years, which, of course, finally lead up to the subject of the Jubilee years. These were times in Israel's history when they were to remember that they were once strangers in Egypt, and it was to remind them that although they were now living in their own land, the life of the stranger and sojourner was to continue, even once they were settled in the land. How so? Just notice, in verse 22 and 23, "And ye shall sow the eighth year, and eat yet of old fruit until the ninth year, until her fruits come in, ye shall eat of the old store. The land shall not be sold forever, for the land is mine." Now notice what's said. "For ye are strangers and sojourners with me." Can you imagine how that would shake them, thinking in perspective? Some 40 years were spent with a lost generation before they entered into the land. No doubt they had thought that once they entered the land of Israel and were settled, and the tribes were given their various portions, once that was done, that they would leave the life of a stranger and a sojourner. Surely they must have thought that once they were settled in Canaan and developed towns and villages, they would no longer view themselves as strangers and sojourners. They might have thought, up to this point, that that kind of phrasing in verse 23 described the life of Abraham and of Isaac and of Jacob, which sojourned in the land of Canaan, but never were given a foot of it. But you know, brothers and sisters, that's not so. Once they got into the land, once they built their villages, once they became more urbanized, we would say, once they were established and settled in their land, they were still to view themselves in their own land as strangers and sojourners. You see what that says to you and I? We can look at the life of David when he was a fugitive, and when he geographically was a fugitive, moving from town to town, over the hills, through the valleys, hiding in caves. We can see him literally as a stranger and a sojourner, and might think that that doesn't apply to us because we're not running from town to town and city to city. We might look at the lifestyle of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and see that they were literally sojourners and pilgrims and think to ourselves, well, I live in a city, in Houston, in Austin. I'm settled. I have a home. I'm not moving around like that. How does that exhortation relate to me? It does relate to you. Because it's not a matter of geography. It's not a matter of whether literally you are picking up your bags every few days or every few months and moving from place to place. It's not that at all. Wherever you are, no matter how settled you are in your own home and city and town and ecclesia, there's a divine perspective here that all disciples of all ages are to see as their lifestyle. And that is, even though the Israelites were settled in their land, they were still to interpret their lives as being lives of sojourning and being a pilgrim. They were to live their lives, no matter how settled, as though they were exiles in their own environment. You see how important this divine perspective is? And that's why, when you now look at that chart again, if we could just open it up, that's why David, a man after God's own heart, was to spend as much time as he did as living the life of a fugitive. For we see on the first part of the graph that from the time when he flees from the court of Saul to the time of civil war, you have almost 12 years. 12 years living as literally a pilgrim and sojourner. Then there's the period of civil war, where David was, geographically, a little more settled. But still, he was living the life under trial, difficulty, and stress. And then, if we move over to the extreme right of the chart, from the time of the sin with Bathsheba until the time when he's finally recalled in 2 Samuel 19, There again is a long period of time when David lives the life of an unsettled, uncertain sojourner and pilgrim. Would you turn now, brothers and sisters, please, to 1 Samuel chapter 18. In the context of David's experiences, we're going to draw out what we think are exhortational points that are valuable for all of us. Let's first of all introduce ourselves to the beginning of David's life as a fugitive. We pass the time of David and Goliath, mentioned in 1 Samuel 17. So this is after the time of David and Goliath. In 1 Samuel chapter 18, I'd like you to look at verses 6 to 9, first of all. 1 Samuel 18, verses 6 to 9. It came to pass, as they came, when David was returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, that the women came out of all the cities of Israel, singing and dancing to meet King Saul, with tabrets, with joy, and with instruments of music. And the women answered one another as they played and said, Saul hath slain his thousands, and David his 10,000s. And Saul was very wroth, and the saying displeased him. And he said, They have ascribed unto David 10,000s, and to me they have ascribed but thousands. Verse 9 begins the trial. And Saul eyed David from that day and forward. Point number one. David's life as a fugitive from the court of Saul is precipitated. It is sparked by something that David had not done wrong. David is going to be forced into the life of a fugitive for reasons that were not his fault. Do you know, brothers and sisters, we can gloss over that as we are now in this section in our readings and not think carefully about what that's showing us. David had not done anything wrong. When we face trials and difficulties, one of the first things we tend to ask ourselves is, why me? And we might look around in our own circumstances at home and in our ecclesia, and say to ourselves, I'm an avid worker in the ecclesia. I'm on the arranging board. I'm involved in the ecclesial activities. I assist at Bible school. I do all that I can. Now, why then am I going through a trial? Why am I facing difficulties? What have I done wrong? David had done nothing wrong. In fact, it was his righteous behavior that actually precipitated the trial. Saul was envious over David's good behavior. It was his good behavior that got David into trouble. You see the point? As David ventures into this phase in his life, notice how it is sparked. And remind ourselves, when we face trials and difficulties, it's not necessarily because we've done something wrong. Sometimes our good behavior and our faithfulness will be the cause of the trial. That by way of perspective as we start this period. Let's just go a little bit back into verse 5 of the same chapter. Here's the divine estimate of David's behavior, which we just referred to. David went out whithersoever Saul sent him, and behaved himself wisely. Behaved himself wisely. You know, that phrase is repeated a number of times in this context, as though the Spirit is trying to remind us, right at the very beginning, David did nothing to deserve the trial. David was a righteous, faithful man at this point. And in behaving himself wisely, in fact, he precipitated Saul's anger. A little bit further, verse 14 and 15. See how the phrase is repeated again, lest we lose sight of it. Verse 14 and verse 15. And David behaved himself wisely in all his ways, and the Lord was with him. But what happens? Well, look at verse 15, how it's repeated again. Wherefore, when Saul saw that he behaved himself very wisely, he was afraid of him. But what is fueling Saul's anger? What is it that initiates Saul's antagonism to David? It's not that he'd fallen from grace. It's not that David was an antagonist himself. It's not that David was cruising for trouble, we might say. David was doing what was right, and that was creating heat. But from this, brothers and sisters, we'll see God places David in a position of trial which will test him and which will test his patience, because he knew he was doing what was right. And really, that's the most difficult kind of trial. To do what's right and to suffer for it taxes our patience, and it taxes our spirituality more than perhaps any other kind of trial. Later on in David's life, if you look at that chart, way over to the extreme right, when he goes into the life of a fugitive because of his sin with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah, during that time of trial, David could rightly assess his behavior as being responsible for his difficulties. David was living with the consequences of bad judgment. He was living with the consequences from his own sin. That's a little easier to cope with when you know you've done something wrong and you're suffering the consequences. But this trial, at the early part of David's life, was not sparked by David walking unwisely. Rather, it was the converse. Just look again as we look at this context. Chapter 14. Of 1 Samuel. Excuse me, just one chapter further. Chapter 15 and verse 17. Chapter 15 and verse 17. Now, this is back in the life of Saul. There's something said here that does have a bearing on how David is going to be able to cope with this trial, at least cope in the long run. In chapter 15, verse 17, when Samuel rebukes Saul at one of the lowest points in Saul's life, Samuel reminds Saul of a perspective he once held. Verse 17, Samuel said, and he's speaking to Saul, "When thou wast little in thine own sight, wast thou not made head of the tribes of Israel? And the Lord anointed thee king over Israel." You see what Samuel's reminding Saul of? Saul, when you were successful from a spiritual point of view, there was one key to your success. And that key was that you, Saul, viewed yourself with the right perspective. As tall as Saul was, head over all the tribes, in his own mind, to start with, he was little in his own sight. That was a divine perspective. And it put Saul, to start with, in good stead with God. Now, it's that perspective, brothers and sisters, which Saul lost, and it's that perspective which, by and large, David managed to hold on to. David lost it from time to time. But unlike Saul, David's pride never dominated him for a long period of time, although he fell prey to it for momentary experiences. The small perspective of himself. Now just notice, go back to that section we're looking at in David's experience, or in that area, and notice how that perspective, no doubt, is extremely important in David's case. David, at the beginning of this trial, expresses the following sentiment. Down to verse 17 of 1 Samuel 18. "And Saul said to David, Behold my elder daughter Merab, her will I give thee to wife. Only be thou valiant for me, and fight the Lord's battles. For Saul said, Let not mine hand be upon him, but let the hand of the Philistines be upon him." Now notice how David responds to this enticement, although he perhaps didn't fully realize that it was. And David said unto Saul, Who am I? And what is my life, or my father's family in Israel, that I should be son-in-law to the king? Do you know those words? And that perspective was once voiced by Saul. There was a time when Saul viewed himself as little in God's sight. There was a time when Saul hid himself, like Gideon. And there was a time when Saul had to be drawn out by Samuel in order to be publicly recognized. There was a time when Saul said to Samuel virtually what David says here. There was a time when Saul asked, really, who am I? That perspective Saul lost as time went along. That's obvious from the passage we've just looked at, when Saul reminds him that there was a time when you said to yourself you were small, but that was changed. But in verse 18, what you read there of David's view of himself was the perspective that dominated David for most of his life. Despite his slips, despite the times when he was given to brief periods of pride, that was the perspective that stayed with him. David viewing himself in right perspective. You know, brothers and sisters, when we consider the difficulties that we have sometimes in our own community, when we discuss among ourselves some of the difficulties at the arranging level, when we talk about inter-ecclesial relationships, many of our judgments are poorly colored because we ourselves, as those participating in the dialogue, haven't got the perspective of verse 18. When we ask ourselves, who am I? When we take the perspective that we are small and view ourselves small in our own sight, when we are not, like the bullfrog, inflated with a sense of our own importance and our own song, when we're not, God can work with us. When we are, our judgments are adulterated. When we are filled with a sense of self-importance, we do not think spiritually. And our assessment as arranging brethren, our assessment as brothers and sisters dealing with one another, is never sound. That's a perspective David had, and it helped him to be victorious. It's a perspective that Saul had, and because he lost it, he fell into the pit of complete destruction. So at the outset of David's life as a fugitive, keep in mind the secret of David's ultimate success. That was one of the keys in David's success, how David viewed himself. He had himself in the right perspective. And that, too, is a perspective needed to successfully come through trial. When we're in the midst of stress and difficulty, and we ask ourselves that old question, why me? There is something that betrays about self-perspective. Why me? That is really saying, well, why not somebody else? Why not the brother in the ecclesia who never attends regularly? Why not the sister who really shows no interest in doing the readings with her family? Why not the wayward brother or sister in the ecclesia? Why don't they experience this trial? Why me? There is a certain self-centeredness and self-concern behind that question. But if we go through trials like David is about to, and keep in mind how we are to view ourselves, if we have the small interpretation of ourselves, it will go a long ways to helping you and I endure the difficulties and the stresses of life. Because the question is not, why me? The question really is, why not me? Why not me? That's really the question. Why shouldn't I face trial? Hasn't Paul said that through much tribulation I must enter the kingdom? Didn't David go through trial? And David was a man after God's own heart. Didn't David behave himself wisely, and yet that simply begat trial for David? Didn't David do what was right, and yet in the process, the reward was difficulty? Why me? No, why not me? David went through it, and so have all the faithful in order to have their characters refined. That's the divine perspective. And to start off in our life as sojourner and pilgrim, and to keep the perspective, the small perspective of ourselves, will do a great deal to lessen the stress and the difficulty of our trials. A little bit further. 1 Chronicles chapter 29. I should have asked you, as we advance to this passage in Chronicles, said at the end of David's life, to have kept your eyes open to 1 Samuel 18. The two passages should be looked at in tandem. 1 Chronicles chapter 29. Now just notice what David says here at the end of his life, at the time of the rebuilding of the building of the temple. And if you have 1 Samuel 18 and verse 18 open, let's just compare them. A most interesting perspective comes through. In 1 Chronicles chapter 29, at the time of David making preparations for Solomon's temple, David, at the dedication of the temple, just before he dies, expresses one of the greatest prayers of his life. And verse 10, David blessed the Lord before all the congregation. And David said, "Blessed be thou, Lord God of Israel, our Father, forever and ever." Then, as we advance through his prayer, look at verse 13 and 14. "Now, therefore, our God, we thank thee and praise thy glorious name." But he returns now to the first question that he asked at the early part of his life. Look what he says in verse 14. "But who am I?" That's what he asked in 1 Samuel 18 and verse 18. "But who am I? And what is my people that we should be able to offer so willingly after this sort? For all things come of thee, and of thine own have we given thee." You see the point? At the dedication of the temple, just before David is about to be laid in the grave, he returns to the same question. "But who am I?" But there's a change. Keep your eyes here in verse 14 and compare it again with 1 Samuel 18. When David says this in 1 Samuel 18, verse 18, he says, "David said unto Saul, Who am I? And what is my life or my father's family in Israel?" What does he say here in verse 14 of 1 Chronicles 29? "But who am I, and not what is my life? What is my people?" The perspective is shifted. Here, with a slight change, the perspective in David's expression centers around who am I, and who or what is the ecclesia, or my people, that we should be able to offer so willingly. In 1 Samuel 18 and 18, he refers to his own personal life, and then he says, "or my father's family." Here he's not talking about his father's family, and here he has subtracted from his phrasing, "my life." There's almost an advancement here, even though it's a repetition of his earlier phrase. Not "what is my life and what is my father's family," but "what is the ecclesia? What is my people? Who are we? We are mortals, the sons and daughters of Adam." The perspective that David expresses here is really the same, by and large, as that in 1 Samuel 18, with one exception, and it's a big one. He expands his perspective here into his view towards his fellow brothers and sisters, and embraces himself with the ecclesia as a whole, and says, "What are we? What are we? Who are we?" He views himself at the end of his life, unlike Saul, the way he did at the beginning, but embracing with a wider perspective now the people with whom he is very closely attached. That, brothers and sisters, was the perspective that David had as a fugitive. And in tomorrow's class, we'll get into some of the specific details of David's life as a fugitive in his first stage.